Welcome to the podcast series, Intel on AI. Each episode explores human-centric topics related to artificial intelligence through conversations with leaders in the field. I'm your host, Abigail Hing Nguyen. Today, I'm here to talk about season two of the podcast, as well as to do a joint interview with next season's host, Amir Khosrowshahi. Amir, thanks for joining me.
Hey, Abby. Thanks for inviting me. Great to be here.
Awesome. Well, so Amir and I met 4 years ago at Intel when Intel acquired his startup company, Nirvana, and he and his company ended up building out our whole artificial intelligence products group. I was working at the time as the legal lead for our AI investments and strategic transactions, and we connected and were able to start working together in this really amazing space on a number of projects, including thinking about some of the key questions around ethics, safety, and innovation, which over time led me to develop this rebranded podcast. So Amir, I'd love to start with you, and can you share a bit about your background and how you came to Intel? How did you decide to move into artificial intelligence even before then?
Well, I got interested in AI initially through biology and neuroscience. I worked summers in high school in neurobiology labs. And in college, I decided to take it a little bit easier and I studied theoretical physics. Then after school, worked in industry and finance and the technology sector. But then I got very lucky to get the chance to return to grad school at Berkeley, where I studied computational neuroscience. Computational neuroscience is a discipline that's at the intersection of a bunch of fields, including neurobiology, machine learning, statistics, biophysics, cognitive psychology, as well as other adjacent fields. The goal of my studies was to get a basic understanding of how the brain performs computations, what computations it does perform, what are the goals of a brain, and I focused mostly on the mammalian visual system. And after grad school, I co-founded a startup that focused on building better silicon brains, better processors for machine learning. And machine learning at that point was becoming an important workload in industry. And we felt we could build much better processors to accelerate machine learning. And that startup, Nirvana, was acquired by Intel about 2 years later, rather quickly. It was a small startup.
It's about 50 people at the time, right?
That's right. And this small startup became the seed for Intel's AI organization, for which I was its CTO, and that's where we met. So Abby, I've been listening to you and really enjoying season two of the Intel AI podcast, which you actually rebranded. You had a vision for the podcast and you had a new approach. Can you tell us a little bit about how you framed the podcast past season?
Yes. So my hope for this podcast was to begin to democratize information around artificial intelligence. The field is actually still in very early stages. And as you know, I found there were so many people interested in learning more about AI, but not really knowing what to read or where they could get access to good information. And there's also still a lot of misinformation out there and a lot of fears around the technology. I also think that information is so important to building public trust in this technology that's going to be shaping all our futures, as well as to help increase accountability. So that was part of the hope here, to reach more of a lay NPR-like and C-suite audience. And I had an amazing season. I really enjoyed my conversations with industry leaders, policy leaders, and others that are applying artificial intelligence to their work in different domains in really creative ways.
So Abby, you had quite a remarkable group of guests your past season, Andrew Ng, Yann LeCun, and many others. Some of these are foundational people in my own education of AI. And I was also introduced to new issues that I don't know very much about. Very difficult issues with adopting and making products out of AI technology. So what are some of the things that you learned from these conversations that were particularly striking and informative that you had not considered prior to them?
Well, it's been a really exciting opportunity to get an inside look at some of the new technologies in the space. So for example, Peter Beal at Berkeley, who runs the Robot Learning Lab, is training smart robots in warehouses, which is a controlled environment, with a greater goal of bringing these robots into the real world where their environments are completely uncontrolled. And I think that's a fascinating problem to be solving. And the Facebook is doing such innovative work across different modalities. So, you know, having algorithms that are able to parse through increasingly complex forms of speech and read, for example, a meme, which often depends on the contradiction between an image and a caption. And then, as you mentioned, Yann LeCun, I took a look at the modern history of artificial intelligence with him. He's the Turing Award winner who founded Facebook's AI research group. And I did an episode on the future of AI with Andrew Ng at Stanford. As you referred to, he's considered one of the godfathers of deep learning. I also had a conversation about whether AI poses an existential threat with MIT's professor of AI and ethics, Bernhard Trout, And I spoke with Congresswoman Robin Kelly recently about the key prongs of an AI national strategy. I really especially enjoyed the conversation with Aviv Regev, who heads research at Genentech. She is pioneering really creative and powerful applications of AI to leverage the field of biomedicine, which is an incredibly data-rich field. And I'm really excited about her work, not only in and of itself, but also as a case study for, I think, many other industries to think about how we can leverage this new technology to really enhance and accelerate our work in other domains. So at the same time, I was really excited to elevate voices like the World Bank with Ed Hsu, who's sitting at the intersection of the application of artificial intelligence to the developing world, as well as Yeshima Bet Milner, who is the co-founder for Data for Black Lives. And on our episode, she made the point that big data is inherently about preferencing the majority. And I was really fascinated to dig into that with her. Her episode actually has been one of our most popular episodes this season.
In addition to talking to many of the folks you mentioned, you yourself have worked on issues around AI and ethics and privacy, including serving with the Partnership on AI. As you would look forward, what are some of the challenges that you see ahead?
So there are a number of challenges still. Many of these we worked on and thought about in our group, things like privacy, the impacts to the workforce. I would highlight three that particularly concern me. One is what I see is we're going to have an increased disparity of information and in wealth. There's going to be some actors, some institutions, or even in some cases, some people who are going to have a lot more information on an incredibly large scale. And so I think this information disparity is going to be exacerbating and contributing to this overall disparity of power with concentration of resources into fewer hands. Then there's the issue of bias, which I've talked about extensively with various people over the course of the season. It's a huge issue. It's very difficult to solve, and it can take a lot of forms. So it could be things where AI systems just simply don't work as well for underrepresented people, like facial recognition algorithms, or it could be implicit or systemic bias. And that, I think, is the more dangerous one, where we don't even realize the biases are there, and we are simply trusting the output of the machines maybe too much. So I think what's especially challenging about bias is that the solutions are difficult. It's not as simple as substituting gender-neutral language, for example, because there are so many other correlated factors that will continue to play into the algorithm's outputs. And if it's reflecting historical biases against, say, women in leadership, this is going to be difficult to fix if we're relying on the underlying data. And the other problem is we don't have one definition of fairness. So, you know, should the data be re-engineered to reflect the majority, equal representation? How do we weigh the individual versus the collective? And then, of course, the answers may vary by state, by locality, and by cultures. The third issue, I think, is safety. Artificial intelligence is a multiple-use technology. It can be used for positive or negative outcomes. And we still don't have a regulatory regime for the release of new AI technologies. But I think what really gives me hope about, you know, this problem, about the future, is that there are really so many great people in this field who are committed to trying to do the right thing and to bridge these technical and policy and ethical questions. And then, of course, there is this enormous promise of AI to transform all lives for the better, and that's huge. So what about you, Amir? When you look at the future of this field, what is it that worries you, and then what's exciting to you?
So you mentioned a host of very thorny social human issues with the use of technology and with machine learning and AI in particular, such as bias and transparency, robustness. There's a long list of things that one has to be mindful of in the creation and deployment of AI technology. So me, historically, in my own experience, I've been mostly focused on the technical side, the biology, the neuroscience side. And many of the things that you mentioned were new to me as of several years ago. I was introduced to them thanks to you, working alongside you and talking to lots of very informed people on the use of technology. That was new to me, as well as some of the folk you interviewed, Jan LeCun, Andrew Ng, and others, the stewards of my field, began to make a very concerted effort to educate my demographic of machine learning researchers and neuroscientists. And this happened in the form of invited guests to some of our largest conferences. They were at first very surprising. Why do we have such a guest speaking? This is not a machine learning researcher, but a social scientist or a cognitive psychologist. But this happened rather early on in this recent explosion in AI, this renaissance. So what am I worried about in that context is I just worried about being educated myself as well as my fellow researchers. I would like them also to continue to be educated in these areas. However, I am mostly, again, focused on the underpinnings of the technology. And what is most exciting to me is what I'm working on currently on the very foundational aspects of computation and how to perform computations such as multiplications and additions and so forth. They may sound boring, but if you compose many of these operations, this is how you get AI systems in the end. And there's a lot of room for improvement in the basic device physics of designing circuitry to have much more power efficiency, have better switches, have non-volatile nature, as well as using new kinds of materials. One of the materials that I'm working on are called multiferroics. So in multiferroics, you're exploiting many properties of electrons, including their charge, currents, spin, and interaction with magnetism. And there's many, many things we can do there that can improve the fundamental substrate for AI in the future. I'm very excited about that. There's also photons. So we can also use light. We currently use light in communication quite a bit. We have fiber optics. However, you can also use light to do computation. And you can also, more recently, use light to store things. You can store and compute and communicate with light. So that's also a very exciting direction. And we can intermingle light and electricity, photons and electrons, to build fundamentally new substrates for AI.
So it's the explosion in computation power that has really enabled the advances in artificial intelligence that we're seeing today. So I actually think, you know, the work that you're doing, which I've seen you working on for a number of years now at Intel, is incredibly important. What do you think are going to be some of the changes in the coming years? What will be unlocked by the work that you're doing now?
So in some ways, we're continuing along the same directions as I have been doing for the past 4 or 5 years. We were designing processors for accelerating machine learning. So in designing a processor, you have several degrees of freedom. You can change the set of algorithms that could be implemented. You can change the circuitry such that it does operations such as matrix multiplication, which occurs a lot in the current state-of-the-art brand of machine learning today, neural networks. But there's many directions which you can push in communication between processors and storage and improvements of other sorts. The one that I've most focused on that I feel has the most potential for being transformative is at the very basic level, at the device physics fundamental level. Currently, all our computers are built on top of one technology. It's digital CMOS. And this has been so successful. It's one of the biggest drivers of technological improvement over the last 50 years. And of course, Intel has played a large role in that history and continues to do so. So I'm actually focused on replacing the very basic fundamental element, the CMOS transistor. There is good reason to do that. And there are many different directions. It's one of the great things about this effort, as well as some of the difficulty. For example, current CMOS exploits a property of the thermodynamics of electrons, that the charged particle has to traverse a barrier through the substrate to go from a source to a drain. That's just one way of doing it. A switch, a zero and one, or on and off switch, using this property of electrons. However, electrons have other properties. They have spin, and they interact with magnetism in interesting ways. There's a field of spintronics where you can leverage current and spin and other properties to make much more efficient switches. So what does that mean for AI and machine learning? If you have much more efficient switches, maybe potentially 10 to 100 to 1,000 times more efficient, that efficiency gain goes all the way up the chain to you using AI as a consumer, that you will get better compute efficiency, allowing AI researchers to make bigger models, to do computations faster, to use less power, to potentially have the elements be non-volatile, so more robust in adverse scenarios, and so forth. I realize that's a very narrow thing to focus on, but since it's foundational, the effects will be seen in all the aspects of AI.
What are some of the things that we'll be able to do in AI that we can't do today?
So that's a great question. So the development of AI in academia and industry, they're staggered in time. So some of the anticipation of future improvements is easy to do. You just look at the current state of the art in research. For example, there is Google DeepMind, and I know that you have interviewed someone from Google DeepMind and have been very interested in their research, as well as OpenAI. They have been able to build reinforcement learning systems that are able to play games such as chess and Go and StarCraft and Dota 2, These are very, very complicated, difficult environments for an artificial agent to navigate. So this amazing technology has not yet made its way into consumer applications, as far as I know. So the most cutting edge. Some of the improvement is going to come from the transfer of this research technology into products. However, I see that as a neuroscientist and being familiar with some of the miraculous things that biological systems can do, I mean, humans are pretty spectacular mammals, but even very basic organisms such as spiders and worms can do things that are somewhat baffling algorithmically. And I feel like there's forms of intelligence or properties of biological systems that far outpace anything that our artificial systems can do. And I feel with 100% probability that many of these things that are still out of reach are going to become new research and new understandings of types of intelligence and algorithms that are potentially very unlike neural networks today. And we'll be able to replicate some of the things that these biological systems do that are currently out of our reach. And of course, there's, I guess, the unknown unknowns where there are forms of intelligence that we have not anticipated, things that intelligent systems can do that are potentially even beyond our imagination, potentially only in science fiction. So Abby, turning back to you, how did you manage to write a New York Times bestseller while you were working in an AI group at Intel?
So I actually get this question a lot. And I think what it comes down to is it's two different types of energies for me. And those two energies end up pushing and pulling against each other in a way that makes me, I think, even more productive. So writing involves this creative energy that is taking a million ideas and impressions and bringing order to them. And working on our team actually in some ways had some similarities. Like I felt like our team was in constant conversation about ideas, which over time would organically develop into projects and other things. But usually work for me is a more structured type of energy. And I found over time that I actually need both to be most productive and also happy.
So Abby, what's next for you? You have this past great season of your podcast and you talk to many of the thought leaders. What will you be doing yourself? What are you excited about for your future and how will it involve AI?
So I've had a really wonderful experience here at the company. I've gotten to do a variety of work within both venture capital and artificial intelligence. I worked on business development and then I worked on thought leadership, writing for Fortune and Forbes, which you were very supportive of. And then, of course, doing this podcast. So one thing that was surprising to me is that working in your group was actually an opportunity to come back to my first love, which was public policy. When I moved here from Washington, D.C., where I'd worked in the government, clerking on the D.C. circuit and working on Capitol Hill, I didn't actually know I could do public policy here in Silicon Valley. But getting to work with the partnership on AI through our team was a way for me to bridge that work that I'd done before in D.C. with what we're doing here in the Valley. So my plans are to continue in the space of thought leadership. As you mentioned, I write novels. I'm also moving more into filmmaking, which has been really exciting. My first novel, Love Boat Taipei, came out in January of last year. It, as you mentioned, hit the New York Times list and is now being adapted for film. That film process is ramping up. And really, the opportunity to see your novel adapted to the screen is a chance of a lifetime. And so I'm excited to go dive into that world. My second novel, Love Boat Reunion, is coming out with HarperCollins in early 2022. And that actually follows a girl in machine learning and artificial intelligence who's trying to bring together all the facets of her life while she's pursuing this dream that seems incredible for her. And I have other stories from Silicon Valley in the works. On the technology side, I'm actually also very interested in exploring the intersection of AI and film technology. There's a lot of really fascinating developments. You mentioned OpenAI. I've been beta testing their GPT-3, which is an incredibly powerful language model that can write very cogent prose by predicting the next word in a sequence based on the ones that came before it. And there's other ongoing developments using artificial intelligence to convert text to images and text to video. There's virtual humans like the Instagram star, Michaela, and the ones that are being developed by Digital Domain, who we had on the podcast as well. And there's also a lot of interesting work going into enhancing photorealism, virtual reality, augmented reality. And I think there's just so many exciting technologies in this space that I'm eager to explore. And I don't yet know what that is all going to look like, but I know that my future is going to be about continuing to talk about these big questions in AI, both on the technical and policy side.
Seems like it's a very rich area and somewhat mind-bending. You yourself are in the AI domain. Your characters are interested in AI. You'll be using AI to generate the content, augment it, make movies. And then there's, of course, the consumer that is an AI agent that's going to be consuming your... I think all that dynamic can generate lots of very interesting future things that I'd like to read. So Abby, you mentioned that you want to augment the creative process with AI. Can you give some specific examples?
Yes, that's a great question. It comes up a lot where people wonder how much can AI contribute to the creative process? Will AI replace creators? And what I found working with GPT-3 is that it's been serving kind of as a sounding board for me. Like I'll kind of put in ideas. And I found it actually, it's really good at imitating tone and voice, which I thought was really fascinating. But if I put in like a couple sentences from a scene and it kind of generates the next couple sentences, what I find is that it gives me a structure. It gives me thoughts about like, oh, okay, like I didn't actually think about what the character was wearing, but GPT-3 wrote about what the character was wearing. And what I would write is not exactly what GPT has written, but it kind of prompts me to think about other things. Or maybe it'll mention the character's father. I'm like, oh, you know what? You're right. Actually, he should be thinking about the father at some point in the scene. And then that'll also inform my writing. So I think that's kind of an example of how we can lean on these technologies to help accelerate our process or maybe serve as a brainstorming tool for me. And I think that also probably works with the way my brain works because I enjoy seeing all the different possibilities and then bringing them together. I think I find other tools like style transfer to be really fascinating. I see this in the visual space, and I think there's opportunities, again, to play around with these. The camera did not replace the painter. It just created a new form of art. And so I really can see that happening with artificial intelligence. I see us incorporating AI into new forms of content creation across many different modalities.
So Abby, it's been really great working with you. I'm going to be pretty bummed not to be working with you closely as we did the past few years at Intel on AI. We're very different people. I'm a kind of representative of one set of the demographic, very technical, research-minded. What have been the challenges of working with people like myself?
Well, I don't know if it's so much challenges, but you know, one of the things you and I have talked about is how different we are and how different our lenses are when we approach artificial intelligence. And I think what really struck me about you, you know, as you say, you come from a deeply technical background, but that you also really value alternative perspectives. And that's actually really crucial for this field. We hear over and over the need to have diverse voices around the table and recognize that AI is going to be impacting people across all sectors. So the conversations that you and I have had about the intersection of technology and policy and how they need to be closely working together to shape this field have been really incredibly valuable to me as I developed my own thoughts on the field, and also really encouraging because these are the types of conversations that are going to be important going forward for the whole industry, where the government is going to be a growing actor. So being able to explain AI technology in a way that our policymakers can understand and vice versa is really important. And that for me actually was a big focus of this podcast.
So how can people and myself continue to follow you going forward?
So I have a website. It's my name, abigailhingwen.com, where people can sign up for my newsletter. And that's where I will send out updates periodically on different things going on with the books and the film and other of my pursuits. And then I'm on social media. My handle is everywhere, Abigail Hing Wen, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and I'm on LinkedIn as well.
Excellent.
And Amir, as for you, I'm really excited for your upcoming season and how you're going to bring your own lens to it. What are some of the key topics in AI that you're hoping to dig into?
So the space of AI has a very rich history going back to the 1930s. And even through my 10, 15 years of experience in the machine learning space, I have encountered many ideas from many brilliant folk that have been kind of steamrolled by this brand of machine learning that is predominant and state of the art today, neural networks. So one of the things I'd like to do is to go back and revisit this really rich history and talk to folk that have had great ideas that I feel have been somewhat pushed to the margin because of the success of neural networks. As neural networks were rediscovered in some way in 2006, that's when deep learning began to take over, essentially. I would like to go back and visit ideas that have been pushed to the margins and will, I anticipate, have the same transformational rediscovery, as well as across the whole spectrum. As I like to continue the human and societal thread, again, as part of my own education, it's really important, but also delve into areas that are not very popular. So I can just say the things that I'm working on currently are definitely not top of mind for the full demographic of AI. So looking at transistors and device physics, and thinking about electrons and photons and bosons and fermions and so forth, the members of this research community, they're pretty good at articulating things to a broad audience. So I like to leverage them rather than myself in trying to bring these ideas and my excitement into the discussion about AI.
So Amir, I am so excited for your season. I'm really looking forward to listening and learning along with you and your guests.
Thank you, Abby. I'm very much looking forward to the next season as well. And I enjoyed our conversation today.